Welcome to a special edition of Oncology Today, focused on the management of metastatic pancreatic cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. As a follow-up to a recent webinar with Dr. Eileen O'Reilly and Dr. Zev Weinberg, I met with Dr. Michael Pishvayan from the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center in Washington, D.C. To begin, I asked them for his reaction to a case presented during the webinar by Dr. Weinberg. First, let's sort of jump into some of the recent data sets. And, you know, it's great. Finally, we have a nice phase three trial, you know, to look at, looking at NALIRIFOX. We actually started out with a case presentation from Zev, a typical case, 63-year-old man, history of diabetes, presents with epigastric pain to the back, 10-pound weight loss. On exam, had scleral icterus and jaundice. Ends up having a 4.5 by 4.1 mass at the head of the pancreas, stents placed, FNA of the liver shows adenocarcinoma, unable to get NGS, and the patient declined additional biopsy, germline testing, no abnormalities. And this patient actually went on the NAPLI-3 trial, did pretty well. I'll tell you about that in a second. But just to backtrack a little bit in terms of the workup, from your perspective, at least at the initial diagnosis of in metastatic disease, as in this case, how important is it to get NGS and how productive is it?
I think it's critically important. We know from the data, and this is data that represents probably more than 5,000 individual patients across 8 to 10 very large studies, that about 25% of all pancreas cancers harbor genetic or molecular alterations that could lead to specific therapies. In many cases, those specific therapies are platinum-based therapy, which we're probably going to use anyway, but there definitely are another 5 to 10% that are going to be outside-the-box type therapies that we wouldn't have normally used for pancreatic cancer. And I think it's really critically important to be able to get the NGS testing. I have to say that a recent presentation at ASCO 2023 with Dr. O'Reilly and Dr. Park's group looked at doing blood testing, blood ctDNA testing, and really kind of honing in or refining when we should be testing, because we know that pancreas cancers are notoriously low shedders. They don't release a whole lot of ctDNA into the blood, and so it's not as useful as it is, for example, in lung cancer. But for patients that you know that you can't get a good tissue core biopsy just because there's not enough, for example, not a large enough metastasis, and you're really left with just the primary tumor in the pancreas, more and more I've been sending those patients blood off for ctDNA testing. And it's kind of hit or miss. If you get a result and you see a KRAS mutation, thus signifying that there is a legitimate test that's been done, then you feel good about it. If it comes back and there's no mutations, including nothing in KRAS, then you probably there just probably wasn't enough ctDNA in the blood. But it is definitely very important because it can definitely guide additional therapies.
So this patient had germline testing that was negative, and we'll talk about the NAPLI-3 trial. But just to sort of put out there, I'm just kind of curious. We'll talk in more depth about PARP inhibitors later, but just at this point and thinking about the, sort of the algorithm of what you're thinking, how would it have been different if this patient, for example, had a BRCA germline mutation? What would your plan be at that point?
At that point, it would be to have in mind a plan to move on to maintenance therapy with a PARP inhibitor at some point down the line. So, for example, my threshold for tolerating side effects and symptoms from the FOLFIRINOX or the NALIRIFOX would be less. I'd be less willing to tolerate that because I know that I have another decent option for them in the maintenance setting.
I'm kind of curious, have PARP inhibitors been used by themselves up front before chemo, window kind of trial in pancreatic cancer?
To my knowledge, no. And we've definitely looked at this. There is about 3 or 4 publications with PARP inhibitors in pancreas cancer, and all of them to date have been in previously treated patients, including patients previously treated with platinum-based therapy. So there's no real sort of pure study. We're actually about to launch a study that will be a so-called pure study of BRCA-mutated platinum-naive patients. And one of the criticisms of our study is that we might not be able to find those patients because all of them will have received platinum already. And I think that's a legitimate concern.
You know, I don't know if you're aware of it, but there was a little study, I think came out of MD Anderson in breast cancer, where they used, in BRCA, they used before they gave them anything. Again, it was sort of this window neoadjuvant truck was there, obviously had a totally different scenario, but they had a pretty high path CR rate. Wow. And I don't think it got, you know, followed up, although I was always like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, we definitely don't, I wish we knew, and we definitely don't know the pure response rate of a PARP inhibitor in pancreatic, in BRCA mutated pancreatic cancer in a non-platinum pretreated patient.
So this patient, of course, as I mentioned, was negative, and at least in terms of germline, and actually went on the NAPLI-3 trial, actually was randomized to go on the liposomal irinotecan arm, did quite well, at least at the point of time that we were following up on the patient. Can you talk a little bit about the background to this study? You know, Zev was commenting that, you know, like he always viewed it as a trial for clinicians, for people in practice, because they, even though maybe it's not, you know, the exciting or CAR T or whatever, it was addressing an important question that clinicians face all the time. So can you talk a little bit about sort of the design of the NAPLI trial, the findings, and kind of what you think it means?
The NAPLI trial asks an important question that's been lingering in our minds for more than 10 years, whether a three-drug, or I know that Eileen tends to call it a four-drug combination because of the leucovorin. I still call it a three-drug combination. But whether a three-drug combination is truly better than a two-drug combination in Gem-Nab-Pac. When those two regimens came out in FOLFIRINOX in 2011 and Gem-Nab-Pac in 2013, there was 10 years of which one is better. We don't know. There was multiple retrospective analyses, including a very large U.S. oncology retrospective analysis. And actually, the growing sentiment was that they were probably pretty much equivalent, including that U.S. oncology retrospective analysis, was that if you kind of level the playing field with regards to performance status, it was almost exactly the same outcomes and survival rates between the two regimens. But we just never had prospective data in this realm. So the NAPLI trial was really valuable in giving us some prospective data comparing a three-drug NALIRIFOX/FOLFIRINOX regimen versus the two-drug Gem-Nab-Pac. The trial was designed to show a benefit with the three-drug regimen, and it did. I'm a little bit more skeptical about the results than others are for a couple of reasons. One is that the overall survival for NALIRIFOX was 11.1 months. And as many have pointed out, sadly, the median overall survival in the original ACCORD trial for FOLFIRINOX 12 years ago was 11.1 months. So we've made exactly zero progress in 12 years with a three-drug cocktail regimen. Of course, I'm comparing across trials. But the other thing that really surprised me with the NAPLI study, and it was a well-run, very well-run prospective international study, but the other criticism was that the Gem-Nab-Pac arm did much worse than what we've seen in some of the modern phase 3 trials where Gem-Nab-Pac was used as a control arm. So the median overall survival in the Gem-Nab-Pac arm was 2 months, something a little bit above 9 months. But actually in three phase 3 trials recently where Gem-Nab-Pac was a control arm, the median survival was about 11 months. So why did Gem-Nab-Pac underperform? I'm not sure that we necessarily know. And again, I'm comparing across trials, but that was the only concern.
So the bottom line is people have to make clinical decisions, and you sort of evaluate based not only on data, but, you know, clinical experience, et cetera. So, you know, there has been the feeling for a while, a lot of people have had the feeling that a three-drug regimen or four, whatever you want to call it, FOLFIRINOX, was somewhat better than Gem-Nab. Did you feel that way? Do you feel that way now, for example?
I do feel that better. I do feel that now, and I have felt that, but I think it's really shades of gray. I don't think it's black and white differentiation. And, you know, if I've got an 82-year-old newly diagnosed metastatic pancreatic cancer patient that I feel perfectly comfortable starting that patient on Gem-Nab-Pac. I will not, I don't feel so compelled to start them on a three drug regimen necessarily. Now, it's a harder decision if they're 65, you know, or maybe it's not a harder decision. Maybe the 65 year old or the 50 year old, I definitely will start on a three drug regimen. But it's not, I would not feel wrong about putting them on Gem/Nab/Pac.
Well, I guess in a way it's sort of starting to bring in the issue of tolerability when you bring up an 82-year-old person. So I guess your thought, so let's focus just on efficacy first. And again, it seems like there's a general feeling both on data and I guess other reasons that a three-drug regimen is somewhat more efficacious. Let's put aside, you know, tolerability. Like you said, not a gigantic difference, but probably some difference so that if you have a younger patient or somebody who wants the very best possible therapy, that maybe there's an advantage to that. Just in terms of efficacy at this point, from a clinical perspective, if a patient says to you, just again, in terms of efficacy, do you think there's a reason to think that maybe the NALIRIFOX regimen might be more or less or the same efficacious-wise to say modified FOLFIRINOX? In your mind, are they about the same efficacy-wise?
Yeah, in my mind, they're definitely very much the same efficacy. I don't think we have any proof or any data to suggest that NALIRIFOX is better than FOLFIRINOX. So I feel I have not actually yet switched to NALIRIFOX in any circumstance just because I think FOLFIRINOX is just as good. The other issue is that the NALIRIFOX regimen, the way they did the study is there was a slightly lower dose of oxaliplatin, a slightly lower dose of the NALIRI that we use for second line therapy. And I've gotten so used to using FOLFIRINOX in the way that I do things. And maybe I could be accused of being too set in my ways, or the other side of the coin is that I'm comfortable with how I give it and probably won't deviate from that.
So I guess the other issue then is tolerability. And it sounds from what you're saying that you feel maybe a Gem/Nab is somewhat more tolerable than the three drug regimens. And do you think there's much difference in tolerability between FOLFIRINOX and NALIRIFOX?
Certainly not from comparing the published data sets. No, I don't think there's any difference between NALIRIFOX and FOLFIRINOX. I think one thing that the other really valuable thing that the NAPOLI 3 trial provided for us is it dispelled the notion that Gem/Nab/Pac is necessarily a walk in the park. And in fact, the hematologic toxicity with Gem/Nab/Pac was clearly worse than it was with NALIRIFOX. And that is definitely something that we see and is one of the reasons that many of us use every other week Gem/Nab/Pac because of the hematologic toxicity.
And another question that we asked, and sort of getting back to what we were talking about before, just to sort of close out the kind of chemo end and the usual therapy type end, are the phase 3 clinical trials that are going on right now that are of interest in pancreatic cancer. Everybody brought up the Alliance A021-806 trial. What's that?
I think this is a really critical study. For 10-plus years now, many of us have been convinced that we should be giving resectable patients preoperative neoadjuvant chemotherapy, but we've actually done that without any true proof. And then the NORPAC-1 trial from the Northern Europeans just came out at ASCO 2023 and kind of threw a monkey wrench in everything, where it actually showed in a similar design study, albeit smaller phase 2 study, that actually patients who got neoadjuvant therapy did worse. There was a lot of legitimate criticism to that study, not so much with the way they ran the study, but with the way that patients, a lot more patients just got gemcitabine because they couldn't tolerate the FOLFIRINOX, et cetera. But it really raised the question, should we be giving neoadjuvant therapy? And the Alliance study and the parallel Dutch study will actually be telling us that definitively.
So a lot of people have brought up the Apollo study, adjuvant or laparib. We'll talk about that when we get to PARP. But you also brought up the issue of the zolbetuximab study, Gem/Nab, zolbetuximab. And I'm curious because it sort of caught me off guard there. What do we know about the incidence of Claudin positivity in pancreatic cancer? And has zolbetuximab been looked at all?
Yeah, so it's definitely something that we're learning as we go along. But when you look at the zolbetuximab, when you look at the claudin-18.2 staining by the same criteria that was used for gastric cancer, so 3+ IHC as positive, in gastric cancer, the rate of positivity is about 30 to 35%. In pancreas cancer, it's about 20 to 25%. So it's not low. And then in addition to that, if you actually look at any staining, it can be upwards of 90% in pancreatic cancer. And that's relevant, not to digress, but that's relevant for example, antibody-drug conjugates that may not necessarily need a high degree of expression. So given the 20 to 25% high expression with claudin-18.2 in pancreatic cancer, I think paralleling the study that was done in gastric cancer with a similar pancreatic cancer study makes just perfect sense. And the ongoing phase 2 randomized trial of gem-nab-pac with or without zolbetuximab is, as I understand, fully accrued or very close to fully accrued and will give us an answer as to whether it actually increases survival for that patient population.
That's really interesting. Another trial that we asked people about was the PANOVA 3 trial looking at Tumor Treating Fields. And of course, at ASCO, we saw a positive phase 3 trial, though a little controversial, non-small cell lung cancer. But there, particularly when you add it to an IO, there seemed to be some benefit. There's also been a press release that went out recently, a negative trial with paclitaxel plus Tumor Treating Fields in ovarian cancer. Any thoughts about this strategy? You know, a lot of people look twice there. I remember when it first came out in GBM, people are wondering about it, but, you know, it's like, it seems like we're kind of, particularly in pancreas, desperate for some other kind of mechanism. Any thoughts about this idea?
I think you're right that we are desperate to look for other ways. I think the science behind this has been retrofitted, but I don't necessarily say that it's wrong. I think that they've gone back and explained how this works after showing that it works in GBM. And I think that the trial in pancreas, I'd be very, very interested to see if it turns out to be a positive result. The only issue is that even if it does turn out to be positive, this is gem-nab-pac with or without the Tumor Treating Fields for locally advanced pancreatic cancer. The only criticism that will come is it's so cumbersome to have this device. So they basically recommend that the patients wear it as long as they can, which, you know, they advise at least 18 hours a day. And, you know, it's like kind of almost like one of the hernia girdles that you wear, that you strap across the belly, and the Tumor Treating Fields is supposed to be exposed right over the pancreas in theory.
So, yeah, we've heard reports of people talking about dermatitis from the electrodes and all. Also, we've heard that they're modifying the way they do it, so maybe it'll be less toxicity. And we'll see whether or not they figure that out, whether or not this is something or that there's some mechanism there that maybe we can tap into a little bit.
So the interesting thing, and I applaud the PANOVA folks for looking for a hard endpoint of overall survival in that study. And it's interesting because if the study ends up being positive, it's the first study that's going to tell us that treating the local disease might improve survival, because we all think that the systemic disease is the bigger problem. And not to plug my own study, but we also presented it at World GI in July, the intra-arterial gemcitabine trial, where we're giving gem-nab-pac, and then after a period of 4 months of induction, we're randomizing patients to intra-arterial gemcitabine versus continuation of gem-nab-pac. And the FDA allowed the study for an interim analysis to be reported. And even at the interim analysis, there was a 6-month improvement in median overall survival for locally advanced disease. So maybe we actually can find different strategies to target the primary tumor in the pancreas and actually improve survival, even if we're not changing the overall systemic therapy.
I hadn't heard about intra-arterial therapy before. How long has that been around, and how do you do it, and how do patients tolerate it?
I was actually so skeptical when I got involved with this study about 5 years ago. I think they've been doing it for about 7 years. It was developed by a cardiologist of all people. And basically what they developed was a double balloon catheter system where the interventional radiologist will find the artery that is most proximal to the tumor, and then they will inflate these two balloons in the catheter and then inject gemcitabine between the two balloons. It increases the concentration and the pressure to get the gemcitabine to the tumor cells significantly compared to, of course, just IV gemcitabine or gemnapac. And the hope is that by increasing the concentration and the pressure, it's getting more drug to deliver to those cancer cells in that very stroma-rich tumor environment and killing more cancer cells.
And are you actually doing this procedure at Hopkins?
We've been trying to get the study open. I really am hoping that we're going to get it open soon. But there's been more than 100 patients enrolled across the country thus far. University of Pittsburgh is actually the lead accruer thus far.
And what's your vision about what's going on in terms of survival? I mean, I could imagine it's just a debulking thing, you know, like when you do debulking surgery with ovarian cancer and most of the tumor is local. Is that your thinking?
I think so. And I would have never, you know, 5 years ago, I would have never said that that would make such an impact on pancreas cancer. But maybe we're being shown that there is some value to, as you describe it, debulking.
Interesting. You know, another thing I saw, as long as we're talking about papers that I was interested in from your bio, is your interest in kind of looking for a biomarker to predict sensitivity to a regimen like FOLFIRINOX, which I guess is really about the platinum, you know, an HRD type signature makes a lot of sense. Where are you right now with that?
I think that we know that certain homologous recombination genes like BRCA and PALB2 are definitely going to be predictors of response. The question is, how do we broaden that? What other DNA damage response and repair gene mutations may equally predict response? What about when you don't have a mutation and you just have a signature, like you brought up HRD signature, like they use in ovarian cancer? And I think that our goal in trying to incorporate all of these is to try and increase the percentage of patients who might benefit from this to, you know, from 12, 15, 17% to maybe upwards of 25 to 30%.
Interesting. So let's again talk a little bit about some of the answers people gave in terms of, you know, their usual practices. So one thing, you know, we again talked about patients are presenting in terms of neoadjuvant therapy, whether it's resectable or not at that point. And it looks like when people are using neoadjuvant therapy, whether it's resectable or borderline resectable, they're going with the three-drug regimen. But what about radiation therapy? In what situations do you do that? Because it looks like there's a lot of variation in that.
There's so much variability, and it reflects how much we just don't fully understand who benefits from radiation therapy. And because of that, I think we've moved away from incorporating radiation therapy early in the treatment and actually added on towards the end of treatment. So we institute systemic therapy first, and then in selected patients, and when I say selected patients, and this is what I tell my patients too, is that we really make a game time decision that's meant to be a group decision between the surgeons, the radiation oncologists, the medical oncologists, and the radiologist as to who might benefit the most from radiation therapy. And there's different goals when I say benefit. The first goal, of course, is to try and render the tumor operable in a patient with potentially operable borderline resectable pancreatic cancer. We just presented a patient this morning in tumor board whose tumor has actually shrunk nicely, but still is just abutting the SMA, and she's had 4 months of FOLFIRINOX. And the surgeon and the radiation oncologist said, you know, why don't you give 2 more months of FOLFIRINOX? We'll look at another scan, but then we might add in some radiation therapy afterwards. Their goal there is because they want to get the patient to the point of operability. A separate context is, when do we use radiation for definitive therapy, meaning that we know that we can't do surgery, but in the context, as you say, of debulking, how can we deliver enough radiation to kill most of the tumor to add to the overall survival of the patient?
You know, when you were talking before about zolbetuximab and Claudin 18.2, you sort of mentioned ADCs. And I was just thinking, because we talk about that all the time, almost every solid tumor, even hematologic tumors, actually, now that I think about it, have ADCs. Anything happening at all in terms of antibody-drug conjugates for pancreatic cancer?
Yeah, definitely. There's some exciting data. It's all early phase, but there are definitely, For example, Claudin 18.2 targeted antibody drug conjugates, gastric tissue and pancreatic tissue, normal tissue, has the highest expression of Claudin 18.2. And so the cancers that arise from those tissues are also those that are most likely to retain expression of Claudin 18.2. And so upwards of 90% of pancreatic cancers harbor at least a little bit of Claudin 18.2 expression. So hopefully that will be something. There are other targets that are being explored as well, like TROP2 and mesothelin. And these are things that have been studied for years.
But is there an antibody drug conjugate targeting Claudin 0.2 right now?
Yeah, there's
really
two or three. One,
really?
Yeah, and I only know because we're opening up the study, but the study's been opened at other centers already, and I think that there are at least a couple of more.
Any objective responses that you know about?
The drug was acquired from a Chinese company, and the Chinese group presented their data at ASCO this past year. The responses were all seen in gastric cancer because it's a gastric and pancreas cancer study. The responses were all seen in gastric cancer, but it was about a 50% response rate with the ADCs.
Really?
In pancreas cancer, unfortunately, it was only stable disease patients, but it was actually a legitimate stable disease in some of the patients.
Huh. Interesting. Let's talk a little bit about second line therapy. And I guess one question would be, and we just go through it, what's your usual second-line therapy in somebody who's gotten Gem-Nab up front? It sounds like that's more likely going to be an older patient, but what are you usually thinking about second-line in those people?
Yep. I mean, we have a level one evidence trial in that space with 5-FU and NALIRI, and so I just don't feel, I don't deviate from that trial. So I'll use 5-FU and NALIRI in the patients who receive Gem-Nab-Pac in the frontline setting. The only exception might be is if the rare patient who gets started on Gem-Nab-Pac, we find out that they have a BRCA mutation or a PALB2 mutation during the course of their Gem-Nab-Pac, I might choose to put that patient on maybe FOLFOX, maybe GemCis in the second line setting. But for most of the patients, it's going to be 5-FU and NALIRI. And then I'll save FOLFOX for the third line setting, which unfortunately most patients don't get to.
What do you think about the investigators, a number of whom say modified FOLFIRINOX?
Post-Gem-Nab-Pac?
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine that a patient who you didn't think can tolerate FOLFIRINOX in the front line is all of a sudden going to be able to tolerate that in the second line. So that's why I tell patients we're going to break up FOLFIRINOX into FOLFIRI and FOLFOX, and we're just going to use them sequentially.
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably what people were thinking. Mm-hmm. What about second-line therapy in patients who got three drug first-line, let's say NALIRIFOX or FOLFIRINOX?
That's an easy one because then I use Gem-Nab-Pac and I use it every other week, and it's very well tolerated. I can't say that it's all that effective, unfortunately, but it is the best that we have in the standard realm. I will routinely try and put patients on a clinical trial as they transition from first to second line therapy. I think those are the best patients for trial to try and investigate the effectiveness of new drugs.
So we talked about looking for the possibility of being able to use a PARP inhibitor. So I assume that germline testing and if possible, either blood-based testing or NGS is standard in the upfront setting and the metastatic setting. You know, I'm always curious about the so-called real-world data that gets generated. We're actually getting ready to do a big project with one of the groups, the American Oncology Network, trying to pull data, actually looking and to try to figure out how they take care of their patients. But I am curious whether you think for real, whether people are actually getting particularly germline testing.
That is a very sore point because the answer is I don't think so. I think that the testing rates are really low. There was an interesting publication that came out where even internally, they looked at how their testing rates increased when they instituted a program to make sure that the investigator or the physician remembered to send testing. And even though it did show an increase, it still only increased from a base of like 50% to up to about 70%. So that means that without any program instituted, still only half the patients are getting tested at an academic center that's looking into this. Nationally, we don't really know what the testing rates are, but it's been long suspected to be only about 30 to 50%. And germline testing is even less than that. It's only about 10 to 15%. It's woefully low. I know that that's also true in ovarian cancer and breast cancer and lung cancer. I just don't know how to institute programs that say we just need to test these things reflexively.
You know, I don't know whether or not it's because I'm talking to oncologists all the time who are like extremely on top of things, and maybe they're not typical. But, you know, I see this all the time. You know, CLL, there's supposedly 25% of people aren't getting, you know, BTK inhibitors or venetoclax up front, which is hard to believe. And I guess I always believe that docs are informed and doing what they need to do. I wonder, you know, is the data being collected correctly? I mean, do you think this is for real?
I think we are in such an echo chamber that, you know, the people that we talk to, of course we all test. I track my patients right. on a spreadsheet, and I keep track of whether I'm remembering to test them or not. But I think the reason I believe this is because the studies that there have been studies done on just our pancreatic cancer patients receiving any treatment of any kind, and more than 50% of patients with a pancreatic cancer insurance diagnosis, an ICD-10 diagnosis, are not getting any treatment for their pancreatic cancer.
I remember hearing that about AML before HMA venetoclax came out. But you think that, that's what I was wondering. Do you think that maybe the lack of testing is part of the pessimism of the disease?
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Because, you know, I mean, I can remember very vividly, we had a case a couple of years ago, patient metastatic pancreatic cancer, who got, you know, of course, most people are not germline positive, but that patient was germline positive. I think he had a niece who ended up getting tested, was positive, had prophylactic surgery, you know, maybe prevented either a breast or ovarian or pancreatic or some other kind of cancer. So, you know, I guess I'm sure you've seen tons of examples where the family is almost a legacy that the patient leaves for the family.
Yeah. I would love to, for those who are studying this, I'm eager to see what the results of that kind of what they call cascade testing is going to reveal. Are we increasing survival rates in breast, ovarian, and even pancreas cancer because the family members are also getting tested?
So let's talk a little bit about the use of PARP inhibitors in pancreatic cancer. Can you talk a little bit about what the trials are, what the data is that we have right now, and what your approach is in your own practice?
Sure. Yeah, so we have a handful of anecdotal trials out of UPenn, the one out of MD Anderson with rucaparib, but really ultimately the big trial was the POLO trial using the PARP inhibitor olaparib in the maintenance setting. And the study was designed paralleling the studies designed for ovarian cancer, looking for the benefit of adding a PARP inhibitor after a period of platinum sensitivity in the maintenance setting. And because of that, again, paralleling what was approved, what led to approval in ovarian cancer, they used progression-free survival as their primary endpoint. And so the study was done across the world. It enrolled about 150 patients, and ultimately the trial was positive, where there was an improvement in progression-free survival compared to placebo after a period of at least 16 weeks of platinum-based therapy for patients with germline BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutated pancreatic cancer. The disappointing part was that a year later, when the overall survival data was released, it turned out that the overall survival was not improved with patients put on olaparib compared to placebo. But there were a lot of caveats there. First and foremost, the study wasn't designed to be able to detect an overall survival difference. And when you look at the survival curves, there was definitely a separation of the curves for overall survival, just didn't meet the statistical significance. And of course, there was also crossover for patients who were receiving PARP inhibitor after progression on placebo to then ultimately get some sort of PARP inhibitor. How do I use it? I really, you know, when you're treating metastatic pancreatic cancer, quality of life becomes as much of an important factor as does extension of life. And the convenience of being able to move on to an oral therapy like a PARP inhibitor, even though it can have its own set of side effects, the convenience is so great, and patients really appreciate the quality of life difference that I will routinely, of course, test patients and anybody with a BRCA mutation or a PALB2 mutation. I will try and get them access to a PARP inhibitor, either in the context of a clinical trial or off study.
And do you view somatic mutations the same as germline, at least from the therapeutic perspective?
I do. And I think we have a little bit of data to suggest that there may be equal benefit even in somatic patients. Kim Rice-Binder did a maintenance rucaparib study. It was not a randomized study, but it was just a single-arm study designed like the POLO study, where patients who had been on platinum-based therapy, then had stable responding disease, were then put on maintenance rucaparib, except that Kim allowed for somatic BRCA1, BRCA2 mutated patients to be enrolled. And definitely some of those patients have fared well, including one of my patients that she put on her study, who's now been more than 5 years on rucaparib.
Wow. Yeah, you hear those stories in a number of cancers. You wonder why those patients are different than the ones who don't make it 5 years. Any thoughts?
I think that so we've been trying to explore this for a while. One of the definite thoughts is loss of heterozygosity of the BRCA mutation. So if you're born with a germline BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, then to have the second gene lost in the tumor is a lot easier. So it makes sense that most of those germline mutated patients have two of their BRCA genes that are lost in the tumor. When you have a somatic-only mutation, you have to envision a scenario where both of those genes are lost within the tumor. But I think it does happen sometimes, probably to a lesser rate than it does for the germlines. And as long as you've lost both of the alleles, then you have a dysfunctional BRCA protein.
Any other mutations that'll get you to think about or try olaparib? I know CHEK2 and ATM are not uncommon. Will you treat that?
So I think we used to get excited about ATM, but I think enough of us just anecdotally believe that ATM is not one that predicts for response to PARP inhibitors, at least not in pancreatic cancer. I know it's different in prostate cancer. There are other rare mutations such as BRIC1 and BAP1, where there's a little bit of data where the PARP inhibitors can be a benefit there. And then there's the infamous HRD signature that we don't test very much in pancreatic cancer outside of the clinical trial, but may actually have some value as well.
If you know a patient has, for example, a BRCA mutation or BRCA germline mutation, you know, family history, whatever, what chemo do you give?
If they have a strong family history, and I'll accept that family history is not all that predictive of them having mutation, but nevertheless, if they have a strong family history, or if they walk in the door knowing they have a BRCA mutation because they had a breast cancer 5 years ago, then I will certainly start them on either FOLFIRINOX, or actually I feel very comfortable with just gemcitabine and cisplatin based on Dr. O'Reilly's phase 2 randomized trial. If I learn that they have the BRCA mutation during the course of their therapy, then I will stay with whatever I started them on, even if it's gem-nab-pac, but just have that information ready to pounce on if I'm going to put them on a platinum or a PARP inhibitor second line.
Yeah, that's why I asked that question, because I find a lot of people talking about cis-gem in those patients. Cis-gem, how that would compare to a three-drug regimen, FOLFIRINOX or NALIRIFOX?
I don't think we have.
I mean, in the non-BRCA patients.
Well, we definitely don't have data. I will just tell you anecdotally, I don't think gem-cis works all that well in the non-BRCA mutated patients. And my anecdotes to be able to say that come from exactly the scenario where you described, where you've got a patient walks in the door, you know, Ashkenazi Jewish, where there's a higher rate of BRCA mutations in that population, strong family history of breast and ovarian cancer, but a little bit older. So I don't want to start them on FOLFIRINOX. So I put them on gem-cis and then initiate their testing. And then 2 to 4 weeks later, lo and behold, they're not BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutated. I find those patients don't fare as well on gem-cis as they might have on either gem-nab-pac or FOLFIRINOX.
Interesting. Any thoughts? You know, we hear this a lot in ovarian cancer, I think in breast cancer, the hope, the idea that adding an IO to a PARP inhibitor is going to have benefit. I know SWOG has a study looking at olaparib plus or minus pembrolizumab, kind of building on the POLO trial. Any thoughts about where that's heading? Seems like there's some hints, and you know, maybe in ovary, but any thoughts?
Well, I'm biased because I'm study co-chair for that SWOG trial that you just mentioned. I certainly hope so. I think that the science behind it is very intriguing, I think it's definitely worth doing the study. I would put patients on that study in a heartbeat. There's some really interesting data that Peter Hossein from University of Miami has really started to build. Now, his study was just a retrospective look at a handful of patients they treated, but they treated them with Ipi and Nevo. And there's some reason to think, well, maybe the CTLA-4 antibody is really needed in this scenario, that just the anti-PD-1 is not sufficient. So in his retrospective look at a case series, essentially, of a handful of patients, there were patients who benefited from Ipi-Nevo, for those who were known BRCA1, BRCA2 mutated, who had previously been treated with platinums, et cetera.
Are reversion mutations seen in patients who get PARP inhibitors? Can a clinician, you know, send an assay to pick up a reversion mutation? And what's the implication if you see it?
Yeah, reversion mutations definitely happen in pancreatic cancer. We have no idea what the rate of reversion mutations is, whether it's 2% or 80%, as conferring resistance to PARP inhibitors. Nobody knows what the denominator or the numerator, for that matter, is. But it can definitely happen. You can send a simple blood test to be able to detect this. That's one place where the blood test actually can be really valuable. The problem with with testing for the reversion mutations, whether you test it for any of the retail companies, ironically, is that the retail companies aren't doing a great job in reporting it. So you'll get a BRCA gene mutation on the report, and it typically has a much longer mutation look to the description of the mutation is much longer. And that's because they're describing the nature of the reversion, but they're not spelling it out for the clinician who doesn't know to look for this, that, hey, this is a reversion mutation. We do know that the reversion mutations definitely confer resistance to PARP inhibitors and platinum. So I would hesitate to use a PARP inhibitor for a patient that I know had a BRCA reversion.
So we asked a few sort of practical questions in our survey about the use of PARP inhibitors or olaparib in pancreatic cancer. One is the issue of GI toxicity, and most people are not using preemptive medication for that. But I just wonder in general how GI toxicity sort of fits in with people who already have a number, maybe already have some issues.
It's so hit or miss, and patients who, how they respond, how they tolerated, for example, FOLFIRINOX well or not so well, doesn't predict for how they're going to respond or how they're going to tolerate olaparib, for example. It's really hit or miss, but I definitely see some patients who sail through it and some patients who have a tough time with it. We do have some data with this with the POLO trial, where about 50% of patients in the POLO trial had to pause their therapy with the olaparib and then go on a lower dose of olaparib. The good news from that was that zero patients stopped olaparib because of toxicity, meaning that even if they had to pause and go on a lower dose, they were still able to continue on.
So another thing, this is kind of interesting. I'm kind of starting to see different parts of oncology kind of this point coming up, which is dose reduction, particularly of novel agents, and more emphasis on that. I don't know. You know, I kind of feel like maybe it's been a little slower in evolving than dose modification for like chemotherapy, for example. So one of the things we ask is, do people use dose reduction for toxicity? Everybody says yes. And you actually, in the survey, talked specifically about how you do that. Can you talk a little bit about what it will take you to reduce dose and how you do it?
So I really sort of follow the protocol of the POLO study where patients were started on 300 BID of the olaparib, and then for the toxicities that make me concerned, sort of grade 2, grade 3, myelosuppression in particular, but even grade 2 or grade 3, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, I'll pause the olaparib until their side effect recovers. And sometimes it takes a week, sometimes it takes 3 weeks. But once they recover, then I'll go down to 200. If they experience it again, I'll go down to 100. And that, again, that covers almost 100% of patients and being able to keep them on therapy.
So one of the things we also asked people was, what's the longest time you've maintained a patient with metastatic pancreatic cancer or in a PARP inhibitor. And I mean, you said over 5 years, you already commented on that, but everybody seems to have a bunch of patients who've gone, you know, a couple years. Eileen has some of 7 or 8 years. Any thoughts about what makes those cases different than the typical cases?
No, I wish that I knew. And that's really the holy grail, trying to understand what it is about those patients. You know, my 1 5-year patient that I share with Kim is, you know, a somatic only BRCA mutated patient. I don't think we know.
So I was actually just flashing on the fact we did a webinar last week with Katie Moore, who did the Solo 1 study in ovarian cancer, which is really, I think, maybe one of the trials that really opened up people's minds to this whole strategy. And of course, one of the issues that came out in ovary, and we were talking about this last week, is the issue of AML and MDS. And you would kind of think this is maybe a less appropriate or, you know, critical issue in terms of discussing with a patient with metastatic disease, and say patient is going on the Apollo trial in the adjuvant setting, although even there, I don't think it's quite the same as the discussions that go on with, you know, breast or ovarian cancer patients. And actually, so we ask people, do you bring this up to a patient with metastatic disease? And although, you know, a couple of people actually said no, which, you know, I can understand, most people say yes. What do you say to a patient who's already got metastatic disease about that?
Oh, I mean, I think of it as just another discussion for potential side effects. I mean, in the same way that I discussed the, you know, 1 in 10,000 patients who are going to have coronary vasospasm with 5-FU, I will also bring up the rate of MDS-AML for the patients who might go on a PARP inhibitor.
I'm also curious about your experience with cytopenias and PARP inhibitors in this setting, again, particularly olaparib. What do you see? How often do you have to transfuse patients?
I definitely see myelosuppression across the board. So unlike chemo, it's not just neutropenia and thrombocytopenia. It can definitely be anemia. And sometimes anemia is the most problematic one. I would say I transfuse probably a little bit less than others, only because I'm a little quicker to drop off the drug if I really start to see the hemoglobin dropping down. But I'd still probably say at least 25-30% of patients will ultimately need a transfusion.
We were talking about the Apollo study, the adjuvant olaparib study. I wonder whether you've been in the position of having a patient, you know, with a BRCA mutation in the adjuvant situation who asked you to use off-label PARP inhibitor. Would you or have you?
So I have, prior to the study being opened, and actually, even when the study was open, I gave a couple of ampullary cancer patients with BRCA-mutated ampullary cancer who wouldn't have been eligible for the Apollo study. I gave them adjuvant olaparib, and I followed the study and gave it to them for a year. It is a struggle, actually, when I offer the trial to patients now, they just want the off-label olaparib. You know, in good faith, we don't know if it's going to benefit them. And because there is this small but real risk of MDS-AML, you know, I could be then doing them harm and without proof of benefit. So I try and nudge them towards the study.
Another question I was going to ask you before is, do you ever see MSI-high pancreatic cancer?
I do. And it's again, I will emphasize that it's still pancreas cancer because I have some MSI-high patients who've done exceptionally well, but I've also seen a couple of patients who don't respond at all. And they're all MSI high, you know, high tumor mutational burdens, but one or two of them didn't respond, which is incredibly disappointing for the patient and for me.
But you've seen objective responses, though, and people are...
I've seen complete responses in a couple of cases.
So let's talk about some other avenues of clinical research interest. And one, I'm curious for your thoughts on, actually, Eileen presented a patient who had KRAS G12C. Of course, we talk about that a lot, particularly in lung cancer. What do we know about that in pancreatic cancer and KRAS inhibitors?
So we know that the KRAS G12C inhibitors work to the rate of probably about 40 to 50% response rate and upwards of 90 to 100% disease control rate for KRAS G12C mutated pancreatic cancer. And that's data with both sotorasib or sotorasib, however you pronounce it, and adagrasib as well. So those are really exciting results, particularly because those patients were pretty heavily pretreated. The only disappointing thing, because it is still pancreatic cancer, is the duration of response is still relatively short. You know, 6-7 months median overall survival and progression or progression-free survival, and not too far after that in terms of overall survival. I think where the promising and exciting data for KRAS inhibitors is where you start to get into the world of combinations. And if I can borrow from colon cancer literature, where Rona Yeager had a trial of cetuximab with adagrasib in KRAS G12C mutated colorectal cancer, the response rate was much higher with the combination than it was with single agent adagrasib, because you essentially are turning the tumor into a KRAS wild type tumor, at least for a while. And so you have the potential to get the benefits of the EGFR inhibitor as well. So studies like that are being designed in pancreatic cancer also.
So right now, are you using KRAS inhibitors in your patients? And in what situations, which one, and what do you observe?
So if we see a KRAS G12C mutation, we are using adagrasib or sotorasib, of course, off-label, if we can get access to it. We also are fortunate that we have a couple of clinical trials with KRAS G12C inhibitors at Hopkins, and we also have a number of KRAS and pan-RAS inhibitor trials as well. So those trials were routinely referring our KRAS G12D, G12R, G12V patients up for those clinical trials. What are we seeing for the non-KRAS G12C inhibitors? I think it's just too early to tell. There are some patients that respond, but of the data that's been collected, it's probably on the rate of about 10 to 30% response rate. But that's really a preliminary look at this body of inhibitors.
I never thought to ask anybody whether there's any antibody drug conjugates to KRAS, is there?
That's a great question. And actually, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if it's specific enough. I would imagine.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah. Is it too much in normal tissue? I don't know.
I don't know either, because certainly the Memorial Group was able to generate a vaccine targeted towards a specific KRAS mutation. So why couldn't they develop an antibody to it? I actually don't know the answer.
The last thing I want to ask you about is vaccines. It's starting to creep up into my consciousness now in the last few months, because first there was a presentation at ASCO, I don't know if you're aware of it, and adjuvant therapy of melanoma, where they used this neoantigen vaccine that was developed by Moderna and targets neoantigens individualized to the patient. Then I started to hear it other places. Then I see there's something kind of like that in pancreas also. I think Eileen's involved with that. So I'm just starting to figure out what this technology is. Maybe you can educate us a little bit. It sounds exciting. Anytime people hear the word and Moderna, they get all excited in particular, although I know there are other companies looking at the same thing. Actually, when we did this program with Katie last week, a couple days before, I got an email from a doc, not an oncologist, who was a patient with ovarian cancer who was on her way to Boston to get one of these neoantigens. So I guess it's for real. It's really out there. What is this, and what are your thoughts about it?
So I think the vaccines fall into a couple of different camps. There's the vaccines that are patient-tailored, that they're taking the patient's tumor and developing a vaccine-specific. As you can imagine, those are obviously much more labor-intensive and costly and slower to produce. But I think they also have a lot of promise. The current vaccine trials in pancreatic cancer, like the ones that Eileen presented at ASCO in 2023, were really just mRNA vaccines to a breadth of KRAS mutations. And it's very, very preliminary. I mean, we're all super excited about it. We're all flooding her with patient referrals because we're excited about it. But so far, all they've shown is T-cell specific responses to that vaccine. And what I tell patients, it's like, how did we know the COVID vaccine worked? Well, we didn't initially. We just knew that there was a T-cell response or an immune response specific to the COVID vaccine. And that's kind of where we are right now with the pancreatic cancer vaccines. We know that there's an immune response specific to that vaccine. We just don't know yet if that translates to actually preventing cancer in patients.
Interesting. Any other innovative responses? I remember there's a patient presented who got something that sounded sort of like CAR T in the New England Journal. any immune approaches that look exciting?
So that one was, I believe that was the Rosenberg group, and well, as with the Oregon group, but they were doing tumor infiltrating lymphocyte injections that are generated towards that patient's tumor. And you know, one of the patients had a very robust response. So there's an active trial going on. We're fortunate because it's, you know, 6 miles up the road at the NIH. So I refer patients there as well. But there are other people doing. Mark O'Hara at UPenn has a really interesting trial that's in the similar vein of trying to look at vaccine or patient personalized immune therapy for pancreatic cancer. I think this is this world is in its infancy, but it has a lot of promise.
Have TILs been used, and do you see responses to TIL?
I certainly don't, but I know that they have been used, and they can be of benefit. It's a very, very small number of patients who have benefited from these therapies, and the million-dollar question is who were they and why did they respond, and nobody really knows, but those studies are ongoing.
Well, you know, we had a lot of concerns about CAR-T and all you have to go through with that, and now bispecifics are coming along, and it looks like really encouraging, so maybe pancreatic cancer will go along that route. Who knows? Yeah.
And I think the answer to that is to try and get patients on study, because we just need to learn. And for better or for worse, the patients need to be our testing ground to prove that these therapies work.
Well, unfortunately, there's no shortage of patients, that's for sure.
True.
Final question. I know we've talked about this in the past. Any new observations or comments in terms of palliative care for pancreatic cancer? You know, this is every oncologist deals with the palliative issues. Any new pearls or things that have come out in that regard?
Actually, there's a couple of areas that I've only learned about myself in the last year or so. First of all, there's a group of investigators that are looking at targeting cachexia specifically. So there are new therapies that really kind of work in the brain to try and limit the cachexia that comes from pancreatic cancer. And they are entering clinical trials. So those could be really exciting. There are also novel ways to try and attack the pain. Again, I'll keep pointing to the NIH just because they're close by, but there's some really innovative pain management trials that are being studied, and pancreatic cancer patients are often targets for that as well.
What kind of pain strategies?
You know, they're injecting something, and I'm going to show my ignorance of knowing exactly what it is, but they're injecting something into the CSF in the spine. Huh. And it's working. It's not an opioid. It's working more in more specific ways on different pain pathways than the opioid pathways.
Huh, that's fascinating. This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Pishvayan, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.